You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Is there a baseball name that resonates more than the name Joe DiMaggio? His evokes greatness. He was mythic, mysterious, and remains so. Very few people gained the privilege of getting close enough to gain the trust of this very private superstar who transcended the game. A peek into his private life may be found in the well-received Simon & Schuster's Dinner with DiMaggio, Memories of an American Hero, from his good friend, Dr. Rock Positano. Doctor, it's great to have you on the show. Not many fans outside his family got close to Joe DiMaggio. You're just 32 years old in 1990. You've graduated from the Yale School of Medicine, carving a career as a renowned foot doctor when you met him. How did this happen?
You know, Ed, it was really my privilege, and even to this day, I still pinch myself. You know, at that time, you know, Joe was very careful about the media, as you know. He was very careful. He wasn't very media-friendly, so to speak. I mean, he was very private, but he did have a tremendous affection for the New York Daily News sports cartoonist Bill Gallo, and he always trusted Bill implicitly. I mean, he trusted him personally and professionally. And one day, they were having lunch together, and Joe was complaining about his heel, pretty much that famous heel that was bothering him in the 1948-1949 season. And as many people know, it was a heel spur surgery that pretty much took DiMaggio out of the game. It was very debilitating for him. And his surgery was not exactly the best result. And even later on, he developed pain and discomfort. And, of course, Ed, DiMaggio loved to be active. He loved to take walks. He loved to play golf. And it was starting to act up again on him. So he shared this with Bill Gallo. And Bill said, you know, Joe, I know this really nice kid. He's a Brooklyn boy. He's a street boy who pretty much has devoted all of his studies to treating non-surgically foot and ankle problems. He says, give it a try. So Joe, of course, was a little skeptical, as Bill told me. But next day, Bill calls me up, Ed, and says, you know, Doc, you're going to be getting a call from a friend of mine, or maybe even better, you may want to drop him a note. I said, well, of course, no problem. Bill, be my honor. And I said, well, what's his problem? He says, well, he has a heel problem. I said, no problem. I said, what's his name? And he says to me, Joe DiMaggio. I says, what? Joe DiMaggio? You know, as in the old man in the sea, Ernest Hemingway novel, Joe DiMaggio? He goes, exactly. I says, okay, no problem. So, you know, basically, Bill says, drop him a note. So I did. I dropped him a little note. I knew where he was staying because Bill told me, never expecting anything to come of it. And later on that night, I mean, I'm in my office around 7 o'clock, and my office manager says, you know, Rock, you're not going to believe this. There's a guy who looks just like Joe DiMaggio in the waiting room. He'd like to speak to you. I said, oh, my goodness, he actually showed up. So I go out there, and, of course, Ed, it was DiMaggio. I mean, it was unbelievable. He was like the Adonis, impeccably dressed, beautiful suit, perfectly made knot, shoes that were spick spining clean. I'll never forget that. I walked up to him, and I said, oh, my goodness, I'm meeting like a god here. So, of course, I had heard that he was a very formal man, and I addressed him as Mr. DiMaggio, and I think he really appreciated that.
Of course.
And next thing you know it, I mean, we got to talking, and I was able to, thank goodness, take care of him. I knew what we had to do. And, you know, after about 3 or 4 months, Joe was doing great, and then after our doctor-patient relationship ended, I never thought I'd ever see him again. And then one day, a few months even after that, he shows up and says, hey, kid, you want to go grab a cup of coffee? And the rest was history.
Wow. How often would you see him since he lived in San Francisco?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, Ed. I mean, Joe had three lives. He really did a great job of compartmentalizing his life. He had the life in San Francisco, the life in Florida, and the life in New York. So he was in New York quite a bit the last 10 years of his life. And Dinner with DiMaggio was really a snapshot of those last 9 to 10 years of DiMaggio's life, but only in New York City. But he would come to the city once a month for usually anywhere from 5 to 10 days. And he loved the city, Ed, because when he was playing with the Yankees, as you can imagine, he had no privacy. He wasn't able to go to a restaurant or go to a theater. People would crowd him. There would be crowds out into the street to try to see or get a glimpse of DiMaggio when he was playing with the Yankees back then. And, of course, you know, the wonderful thing about it is that he loved New York City because he felt alive here. He was able to have fun. He was able to go out. And, of course, he developed a really nice relationship with a small group of us. We used to call ourselves the Bat Pack. Sinatra had the Rat Pack, yep. And DiMaggio had the Bat Pack.
I'd rather be hanging with you guys, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, we would get together. But, you know, the wonderful thing about Dinner with DiMaggio, the book, is that Joe looked at the dinner table as a sacred place. I mean, that was a very Italian thing back then. I mean, people who were allowed to sit down at the table with DiMaggio, which was rare. I mean, getting a dinner with DiMaggio was rarer than even getting into Studio 54 back in the 70s, because he was so careful about who he would sit down with and break bread with. And the reason being is that the dinner table represented a very sacred place to DiMaggio. So, again, you know, one of the things we wanted to make clear, Ed, when we wrote Dinner with DiMaggio, is that, you know, there's three things that we'd like our people to realize. Number one, it's not a tell-all book, which means there's a lot of things that Mr. DiMaggio shared with me that would never, ever go public. Number two, it wasn't really a book about baseball, even though he talks about really interesting baseball stories. He talks about hitting. He talks about Ted Williams. He talks about the mental importance and the mental acuity of being a baseball player. And then number three, also, it's not a book about Marilyn Monroe, which really a book about what made this man tick. Because so many things have been written about DiMaggio, Ed, and really not one of them really looked at that beautiful side of him. He was a very sensitive, caring, kind, considerate human being. And that was one of the privileges that I had. I got to see this firsthand, right at the dinner table. And it was such a treat for me to be able to share those many, many experiences with Joe DiMaggio.
But you never spoke first.
No, you never did. I mean, there was certain things that you would not discuss at the dinner table, ever. You know, Bill Gallo gave me a great, great tutorial. He says, listen, Doc, this is the key to dealing with Joe. Three things. Never, ever, ever bring up, unless he brings it up. You know, number one was never discuss Marilyn Monroe. Number two, never discuss the Kennedys. And number three, never discuss Frank Sinatra. He says, if you bring up any one of those things, then you may have a very short dinner. So I took his word to the letter. But sometimes, you know, when Joe was sitting and talking at the table, he'd just bring up funny little stories. He'd talk about Marilyn. He'd talk about Mr. Sinatra. He would talk about politics back in the 50s and the 60s. And, of course, you know, the key was not to pretend that you weren't really listening to what he was saying. Because, you know, he used to love to tell you these little anecdotes that were really kind of fascinating. You know, one of the things he always said about Marilyn Monroe, he said, you know, Doc, you know, a lot of people thought that Marilyn was a dumb blonde. And he says she was far from a dumb blonde. She used to be able to memorize scripts, two or three scripts a day, to be able to recite them. And he says people don't realize that being an actor or an actress requires a tremendous amount of intelligence. So it was really kind of fascinating because he gave me a different side to what was going on. And, of course, the same thing about Sinatra. You know, one of the beautiful things about Sinatra was that even though they had their problems during the latter part of their life, you know, they really did have a bond. And their bond was they both deeply cared about each other's sons because both sons were younger. They had, you know, fathers who were magnificently successful. And they both had the same name as their fathers. But, you know, one of the things that really bonded them together, whether they were speaking to each other or not, was that they did care about each other's kids, which I always thought was very, very touching.
Dr. Rock Positano has written the well-received Dinner with DiMaggio, Memories of an American Hero from his good friend. And this must have been a out-of-body experience. Here you are sitting in these restaurants with this guy. Everybody in the joint knows who he is. He's as famous as the President of the United States. It must have been so hard to just concentrate to listen to what this guy was talking about, because he was most comfortable when he was at dinner with somebody he trusted.
That was the beautiful thing about it, Ed. The experience of sitting with DiMaggio was really fantastic. But I think the advantage that I had, and one of the things that Mr. DiMaggio liked and was comfortable about, was that, you know, he realized that this wasn't about hero worship, because I never saw the man play. You know, one of the few things that got on his bad side that we mentioned in the book Dinner with DiMaggio was when he once asked me, he says, you know, Doc, you never asked me or talked to me about baseball. And I says, okay, Joe. He goes, so tell me, Doc, who is your favorite baseball player? And I says, oh, boy. So I told him the truth. I says, Mickey Mantle. And he wasn't too happy about that. So a couple of days went by. He wasn't exactly talking to me for a few days. And then, you know, I says, Joe, you know, you could understand. I never saw you play.
Right.
I mean, you know, you played your last season with the Yankees in 1951. I wasn't born until the late 50s. I said, you can't hold it against me. I never saw you play. I saw Mantle play. And he got a kick out of that. You know, he really did. But I think the advantage that we had was that, number one, we were street boys. You know, we came up in Brooklyn, a great neighborhood. People there were really fantastic. Everybody pretty much minded their own business, Ed, as I'm sure you know.
Right.
And I think he felt very secure knowing that I sort of knew the ropes of New York City.
And bonded over a shared heritage, both being Italian-Americans.
Yes, and of course that didn't hurt, okay. But what people didn't realize also, Ed, was that Joe may not have had formalized education, but he was one of the most intelligent people you'll ever meet. I mean, he was really nothing short of a genius. And I think he also respected that I was a nice street boy, an Italian-American boy from the neighborhood, who was able to, you know, to go to great, great schools and great colleges. And, of course, you know, winding up at Yale wasn't a bad thing in his mind because, as you know, his son had gotten into Yale on his own, you know, when he was growing up. And I think there was that bond of, you know, street smart, book smart, you know, savvy, et cetera. And I think he felt very comfortable around me. And that's one of the reasons why Bill Gallo from the New York Daily News thought that I would be a good match for him.
And what do you think was the secret to gaining his trust?
I think the most important thing is DiMaggio's theory was always start people out in the negative column. He once told me that right out. He goes, Doc, I start everybody else in the negative column. And they have to prove to me, know how good they are. And pretty much that was his way of doing things. And I think, you know, I think the most important thing was that I was consistent with him. I was never late. I always kept my mouth shut. I never spoke with people about him, about the things that we did. And, you know, he had this amazing intelligence network where he knew exactly who was saying what around New York City or anywhere else. And thank goodness, you know, we always came out clean. I mean, we always kept our mouth shut, and he appreciated that.
Mm.
But I also feel that he knew I cared about him deeply as a human being. Again, I didn't have that stigma as everybody else had of being a fan of his, you know, idolizing him. I mean, I took him for face value, and at face value, there was no kinder, gentler, intelligent, caring, honorable, loyal friend than Joe DiMaggio.
I know you have to get back to your practice, but we have to get this material in. There's an amazing story in your book, in your foreword, from Francis Ford Coppola, who was a 9-year-old half paralyzed boy with polio and was one of Joe DiMaggio's biggest fans, and he wrote a touching story that's included.
Well, that was amazing. I mean, that did so many things for what we were trying to achieve in the book, because Francis Ford Coppola's story about how DiMaggio cared about him and went out of his way to get a autographed baseball from all of the Yankee players on his own. Joe actually went from all the players to get Francis Ford Coppola, who was a little boy confined to a wheelchair. DiMaggio went to all of his teammates and made sure every one of them personally signed that ball for Coppola. And I think that's what really embodies the whole book, that this shows that side of DiMaggio that really not too many people were able to relate. And that's one of the reasons why my brother John and I was so thrilled about Mr. Coppola's involvement, because it really did substantiate that kindness that he showed for people. But as you know, Ed, you know, we always spoke about what was his greatest legacy. Well, you know, it wasn't the 56-game hitting streak. It wasn't the 9 World Series championships. It wasn't the 10 American League pennants. The most important thing to DiMaggio was taking care of children, which is why when he established the Joe DiMaggio's Children's Hospital in Florida, that was probably his biggest achievement and the one that he was most proud of.
And there's a touching story of Joe DiMaggio's last at bat, not in uniform in the major leagues with the New York Yankees, but in his late 70s in, of all places, Coney Island.
Yeah, what was happening basically, Ed, you know, I was invited to do the Artist Writers baseball softball game out in the Hamptons. And, you know, Joe was very worried about his image. And he told me, he said, look, Doc, I know you're playing in that game, but remember something, you know, how you do is a direct reflection on me. I says, okay. I said, Joe, put some more pressure on me. So we went out to Coney Island. It was really quite significant and really, really surreal in many respects. We went to Nathan's first, got a couple hot dogs, and nobody recognized him, which was the greatest thing, not even when he was in the batting cage. I mean, and what happened was he was getting frustrated with my batting, and he says, you know, let me show you how it's done. So he got into the batter's box. He wound up hitting maybe 8 or 9 balls, but, you know, just watching DiMaggio hit, even though it was clearly 50 or 60 years later, and clearly not the same body that we all recognized back in his playing days. It was like one of the coolest things ever. So it was one of those things where, you know, when it happened, you couldn't believe it happened, but it was there. But that's something that will always be in our memory.
He lost three seasons at his peak to World War II, and you write that he was upset that he was not allowed into combat.
Yes, because he wanted to be a real, you know, American patriot. I mean, he felt bad about his ability, you know, not to be able to go into combat. But of course, the government was concerned that, God forbid, if something happened to Joe DiMaggio, it would be a tremendous knock to the nation. I mean, many people would have felt very horrible about that. So, Joe got relegated to doing these little celebrity baseball games that they go around from camp to camp. But, you know, he still kept his integrity, and he still was able to entertain a lot of troops. Not like Elvis Presley did, but clearly he was still very committed to helping the United States inside the war effort.
He awed even Henry Kissinger. He had a thing for L. McPherson. You got to pick up the book. It's a snapshot of the last 10 years of Joe DiMaggio's life in New York City. It's Dinner with DiMaggio, Memories of an American Hero, from his good friend, Dr. Rock Positano. Thank you, sir, for being with us. So that'll do it for Dr. Rock Positano and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride. And thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.